Welcome to Blackter. Join me as I examine the best of Black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Blackter. I'm your host, Gabe Moses. Last episode, we took a look at the multi-talented choreographer, dancer, and actress, Miss Debbie Allen. At the end of that episode, you may remember hearing this.
You told Hoppo to beat me!
That was Danielle Brooks as Sophia in the Broadway musical The Color Purple. In today's episode, I'll be talking to an actress who worked alongside her, as well as Cynthia Erivo and Jennifer Hudson, the talented Phoenix Best. As a swing in The Color Purple and Alana Beck in Dear Evan Hansen, Phoenix Best is a young, up-and-coming actress who is just at the start of her career. Throughout the episode, I'll be talking to Phoenix about her roles on Broadway, regional theaters, and what it means to be a Black musical theater performer. I'm very excited to bring you the first of many interviews this season. So, without further ado, let's get into it. All right, I am here with Phoenix Best. How's it going, Phoenix?
It's going pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing good, good. So yeah, so let's just start with this. Were you born to be a performer, you think, or was it just something you were interested in at an early age?
Oh yeah, I think I was definitely born to be a performer. But I definitely have taken a different route than I thought I was going to with performing. And so, yes, I think I was born to be a performer.
Yeah. I have to agree with that too, on your end and on my part as well.
Yeah.
So do you remember your first performance in front of an audience?
Oh my gosh. I remember, like, I play piano. So I started playing piano when I was 4. So I was constantly at least performing, playing concert piano in front of many people from the age of 4. But my first like real performance where I was like singing and performing would probably be the 6th grade. I did a production of Fiddler on the Roof, and I was one of the only Black Anna Tevkins. So that was quite the experience then, yeah.
Yeah. Was that the moment where you thought that you could probably do this for a living, or what did that come later?
I always wanted to be a singer. Like, that was my goal, my dream. Like, I wanted to release my own music and I wanted to act on TV. And I knew I was going to get there somehow. Still haven't gotten there yet. Still the plan. But when I did my first musical in middle school, I definitely was like, okay, wait, I really like this. I'm singing and acting at the same time. This is quite fun. And I think it just kind of snowballed into me continuing to do it and learning more about it. And then it became like the way I breathe, pretty much.
And I think too, like the two kind of go hand in hand almost, especially in a theater setting when the music is a part of the storytelling. So
yeah.
You want to speak to that? Like, how does music and theater kind of coincide?
Yeah, I've done mostly musical theater in my professional journey, but I just think music is something that everyone understands. Like, you don't need to know the language in order to know the feeling and the emotion behind a song. It is quite universal. And so adding music to theater makes it a more universal thing. Like, I have a friend who's doing a production of Phantom in other countries, but they're still doing it in English. Like, they haven't learned any other language those countries. Right. And so that's why I think it is so universal and so important to so many different people.
And so as a Black woman, how did you navigate at an early age, you know, performing among people who were, you know, white?
Yeah.
Into high school, into college, how are you navigating, you know, being around people who weren't necessarily like you?
Yeah, I definitely think it took me until I did my first Broadway show to understand the importance of what has come to be known as tokenism. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds like it's inclusion and diversity, but it's really just tokenism, but you add more than a Black person. And so at a young age, I don't think I noticed it as much because where I went to high school and where I went to middle school, it was predominantly white, but it was very mixed. So I think as a kid, like, I didn't think about it as much. In college, I definitely noticed it because I was the only Black female in the theater department for 3.5 years. There was another Black girl who came and was like, no, thank you, after one semester.
Yeah.
But many Black people did in that department because there was not as much representation. It has changed now, which is fantastic. But yeah, being the only Black female, I got told no a lot. I got told no about shows specifically because I was Black, specifically because they were doing shows about white people. And it was never the reverse for me. And so I think when I moved to New York, getting told no so many times, like, I was ready to be 3 times better than everyone else because I was ready to get told no. I was ready to get told no because of my skin color, because of whatever else, but mainly being a Black woman. And it's so ironic that my first show in New York ended up being an all Black cast. Yeah. About a story about, you know, the main characters are 3 Black women. And honestly, that show changed my life for the better. It made me proud to be a Black woman in general. And then it made me even more proud to be a Black woman who does theater. And then it made me proud to be a Black woman who does theater on the Broadway American stage. Like, the tears in which I, like, gained confidence about being a performer and being a Black woman, I used to lump them into one thing, being like, I couldn't do anything more because I'm a Black woman performer. But I am a Black woman, and I am a performer, and I am a Black woman performer. And that is so important, and it's something I didn't realize at, you know, the ripe age of 21 moving to the city.
Yeah, well, snaps to that. And that goes to show you that the education system and the real world doesn't necessarily, they don't reflect each other because, you know, you're not going to have this full scope of people to choose from in a university setting, you know, which is has its own problems, of course. But before we go into The Color Purple, do you want to talk about being the first Black princess at that university?
Yes. What was it? After my sophomore year? I think it was between sophomore and junior year. I don't know what, like, it was, but I was like, I am sick of seeing the same white girl play, like, the same version of the white girl play a princess. Like, there are princesses. Tiana's a princess. Like, I mean, she was the only example at the time, but
yeah.
I just remember being like, I'm not going in there thinking they've already told me no. So I went in and I auditioned. I was like, I'm auditioning for Cinderella. And I remember when I got it, there was a little bit of anger amongst people. And the feelings I got from so-called friends were not the same as I would have given to them or expected of me to give to them when they usually get those roles. And playing the role in PSF, when they do the children's shows, there's times where there are people, like, children of color. The shows. There are groups and groups and groups of children of color coming to see these PSF children's shows.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, all right, I'm playing a servant. And I, you know, it was, I was a sophomore. I was new. You know, I played a servant. It was Beauty and the Beast. Most of the roles are servants other than the Beauty and the Beast. But I just remember thinking when I got the role, all those little kids, all those little girls who I saw who, like, look up to the princess would finally see themselves. And truly, the first time I felt like I ever saw myself was when I saw Brandy play Cinderella. And that was a huge reason why I wanted to play it, because I was like, okay, Brandy can play Cinderella. And what's funny is right after, Kiki Palmer then played Cinderella on Broadway. So I was like, I am in this long line of Black women playing Cinderella. But I did at one point get one white child who came up to me, and it was like the second to last performance, and I was like, well, Cinderella can be whoever Cinderella wants to be. Like, Cinderella is not based on a skin color. I probably said it much better than how I'm saying it now. Sure. And the little boy was like, yeah, you're right. And, like, that was it. So having the little girls be like, oh my gosh, she looks like me. She looks like me. The smiles on their faces, just that one chance of representation probably made so much more of a difference for all of those kids, including the little boys.
Yeah, and it's crazy how like that story just is like happens throughout generations, you know, like you said with Brandy and for us with, like, I grew up watching The Wiz, the black version of The Wiz, and that was my representation of like, oh, I could, you know, be performers and sing and dance on stage and on film just like any other person, you know? So, yeah, it's sad that it has to be that way and that black children, black young people have to experience it that way to see at least one person, like they're searching for it, but that's kind of how it is. And sadly, you know, hopefully in the next few years and the future, that won't be the norm. Yeah. So do you want to tell your story, you know, your New York story of how you went to New York on a whim after graduation?
Yeah. So my last year at PSF, and it was within the, I think, last week of shows as well. And I had checked playbill.com almost every day at the end of my senior year, as well as over PSF. It's where you can find any auditions. And I saw there was an open call for the understudy of Elphaba on Broadway. And I was like, you know what? I should go. I should do it. It's on a day off and I can just take the bus. It's fine. I'll take the bus up. It'll be good. And I remember going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, being like, you're not good enough. You should just do it. They don't know you. It's a good thing they don't know you. It was like all these things. So I got on a bus at 7 a.m. on a day off and I went to New York and I got in line and I ended up running into somebody I met at PSF. Her name was Jennifer Apple and she played Seidel in Fiddler on the Roof the season previous to PSF. And she was like, hey, and it was nice to see a familiar face, another woman of color. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I went in and I had to sing and they gave us like a chunk of the song. And then by the time it got to me, my time slot was like 4 o'clock. And I was like number 400 and something. They had cut the song down even more. So only got from, I'm not actually going to sing it, but I left, I got right back on the bus and went right back to PSF. And on the bus ride, I got an email saying I got a call back. And I had to tell them at PSF I could not show because I needed to miss it for a callback for the understudy of Elphaba on Broadway. And long story short, I ended up doing about 3 more callbacks over that week. Then they were like, okay, come back on, you know, whatever day. And I came back and it was a dance call. And I was sitting out in the hallway and it was me and one other girl, like waiting for everyone else to show up until the casting showed up and we realized it was just the two of us. So I had gotten down to the final two for the role. I, you know, gave it my best. And the other girl was in Les Mis at the time on Broadway and she had been in a couple other Broadway shows. So like, I kind of had a feeling it was probably not mine. It wasn't gonna go to me. And of course, like the millennial stalker I was, I stalked her on Instagram and that's how I found out she got the job. Wow. But the casting people called me and they were like, well, actually they emailed me and they were like, hey, we think you need to move to New York. Like you got down to the final two on your first major audition in the city. You need an agent, you need to move to New York. And I was like, I don't have money, but okay. And I moved to New York 7 days after leaving PSF. I moved in with two PSF alumni, Marnie and Zach. They were absolutely amazing. They let me stay with them for about a week and a half until I got my own place. And within that week and a half, Telsey and Company, who was the casting agency, kept calling me back for other things, one being The Color Purple. And I went in and I auditioned with the wrong song and never heard back. And about 3 weeks later, they called me back in. I had better material this time. And I ended up getting the swing/assistant stage manager.
Yeah. What a way to make a Broadway debut.
Right.
So I want to ask you now, like, what was it like? Because you were talking about this earlier, just being around Black excellence 24/7.
It was quite intimidating. I had been told my whole life, white enough, of course, because I'm a Black woman. But I also was told by the Black community that I wasn't Black enough because I was surrounded by whiteness all the time. And so that was really hard for me because I never felt good enough for either group. Knowing inside, like, I'm a Black woman, but I just was like, if I can't be accepted by one side or the other, I can at least try to be accepted by the people I'm surrounded by the most. And I just saw small things change about me throughout the course of being in The Color Purple. And it was a group of people who never diminished what Black person I am and nurtured me and helped me learn things that I didn't learn in school or even from my family. But then it also helped me realize how Black I have been my whole life. Like hearing the Black people in The Color Purple talk about their experiences, I had many, if not most, of those shared experiences, but I let myself diminish them. And, you know, the show starts off in a Black church. And like, that's how I grew up. I grew up singing in a Black church. Like, I had never taken voice lessons. That's where I learned to sing. That's where I got my voice from. And so just having those moments, and on top of it being surrounded by Black people all day, every day, let me feel as powerful as I wanted to be. And also watching them do the show, like as a swing, I would watch the show almost every day or do the show or rehearse the show. So I was immersed in that thing. And I remember in the rehearsal room, maybe about the second week or something, we were doing the beginning act. There's a portion where Nettie says it was like Black seeing Black for the first time. And our show had stripped down all the like fancy things that you saw at Broadway, and our props were chairs, baskets, and sheets. And we had these African print sheets that were like going up and down along with, you know, the breeze. And she says it was like Black first time, shiny blue Black people looking real fine. And the first time she sang that, everyone was in tears. Everyone felt seen. It was such a wonderful experience. And also to know that my Blackness helped other within Blackness made it even more significant and amazing for my life.
That's amazing. I don't have any comments there. It's just, that's amazing. On a scale from 1 to 10, how much do you think you've grown as an artist, as a performer, just doing that show?
Oh my gosh. I would say a 9, at least a 9.5, yeah. Because I was a swing, understudied 3 people, and I had never been a swing before. I had been an understudy, you know, at PSF or at DeSales, but I covered 3 roles originally, and then they added 2 more roles. I was also the assistant stage manager, so I got to see everything backstage. I ran the deck backstage. It helped me get close to some of the people I'm currently close with in that show. Because if not, I would have just been in my dressing room the whole time. It just pushed me further than I had ever been pushed in my life, as it was just the fact that it was a Broadway show. It was my first thing post-college. Like, it pushed me in so many ways. So yeah, I would say a 9, 9.5.
Cool. And then next we have Dreamgirls, which you did in Houston, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And of course, like another show with strong, independent Black women. So was this one of the shows where, you know, you dream of being as a young girl?
Oh my gosh. I wanted to be Dina Jones all day, every day. Yeah. I remember getting the audition and being like, somebody thinks I could play Dina? Oh, I'm there. I'm in it. But yeah, to go from being in Color Purple to then being in Girls, I had such a different experience coming off of the high of coming off of the like, I'm Black and I'm proud and I'm about to enter another Black space. And like, 4 Dreamgirls, our director was Black, our choreographer was Black, our music director is Black. So it was also different, because it wasn't the same for the team with The Color Purple. So it was like Black, 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 Black. And I was here for it. I was in the process of transitioning to going natural with my hair at that time from something I had learned while I was in The Color. And I just felt like I was surrounded by such love, but it was also quite intimidating because it was my first lead role. It was quite scary, but exciting.
Yeah. We'll be right back after this break. the episode. Do you want to talk about your Les Mis story and how being in that show is kind of like a full circle moment for you?
Yeah. So I actually auditioned for Les Mis before I left to do Dreamgirls. I did like a self-tape and I didn't hear anything. And then I ended up going back many, 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 many times for Les Mis. And I originally, the first time I saw Les Mis was at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from. I needed a summer job. I needed a winter job. And so I was working in the ticketing office, which is not like a ticket booth. It's like cubicles and headsets and like just a bunch of computers doing tickets. And it's a lot. But they had free tickets for one night because it wasn't sold out. And I went to go see it with my mom and sister. And I seeing the show and being like, I want to play that role. I want to be Eponine. Like that. Want to do. That is amazing. Funny enough, I booked the role of Eponine, and almost 5 years to the day, we were back in Philadelphia at the Academy, and I was Eponine, and it felt so freaking epic. It felt so amazing to think like there could be a girl just like me up in the nosebleeds looking down and being like, I want to play that role because I see this Black girl playing this role. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah, and to speak about the character too, you have one of the most famous songs in the show. So how do you relate to that? You know, especially since the musical is a period piece set in France in the 18 whatever. so like how does Phoenix relate to that?
Well, definitely the first time I did Les Mis, I had never really traveled like that. The furthest I had gone was at Dreamgirls production in Houston. So traveling around the world was quite hard for me, and I did feel quite alone a lot of the time. Sometimes you kind of lose yourself in moving around so quickly and doing so many things. And I felt like on tour, that was my like moment to center myself and like be in touch with me. I was the only person on stage. I could just release it all in that moment. And, you know, one of the most important songs in the show and one of the most talked about songs, some pressure, and it definitely did in the beginning. But by the end, it became something where it was like just a conversation between me and the audience being like, we all have rough days. We all have rough times, but we're all going to get through it. And show for you right now, like I'm supposed to be like this perfect version, but I'm really not. And you don't have to be either. So yeah.
I was going to ask if you had any like fun, not like horror stories, but fun moments that happened. Because you did that run for quite a bit, didn't you?
I actually only did it for about 4 months. Mm-hmm. But then when I went back, I did it again for 4 months. So yeah. I guess in total, I've done it for 8. And each time was quite different, I would say. I don't know if there was anything like super fun, but I will say there were a couple weird moments. There was one time where we were doing, so everyone who's not Valjean and Javert are in the ensemble at some point of the show. And I am in the ensemble from the beginning of the show until the end of Lovely Ladies. And we were doing Lovely Ladies. You know, we're out there in our corsets and thigh highs and boots. And so we're not wearing very many clothes. And we had to stop the show at that moment because a man was having a heart attack during that scene. It probably was starting to happen before that scene, but the commotion really happened while we were in like the scene right after singing this song. And I mean, it's not funny, but it was funny in the moment that we're thinking like all these half naked girls on stage gave this man a heart attack and we had to stop the show.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Not funny. Yeah, that's good. I don't think I know the story of how you got the role in Dear Evan Hansen, so I'd be happy to learn what that process was like.
Yeah. I initially auditioned for Dear Evan Hansen before I did Les Mis and after I did Dreamgirls. I randomly got an appointment for the vacation cover of Alana. So at the time, Krystalyn Lloyd was playing Alana on Broadway. And I did a couple auditions, about, I think, three, maybe four, and I got the job. So that meant that I was just going to be with the show for about 2 weeks, 1 week of rehearsals. And then the second week, while Krystalyn was on vacation, they only had one understudy. Her name's Olivia. And she was going on for that week for Alana. But she also covered Zoe. And since there was no one else, I was there truly as a backup. The wheels fall off, then we have to put this girl on. So I did about a week of rehearsal, and then Krystalyn went on her vacation and Olivia was playing Alana. And it was the Friday, which meant it was my last rehearsal. And I did a rehearsal. My mom and sister were coming to see the show that night. I was like, I have house seats, or I can get standing room to one of the hottest shows on Broadway. Like, Mom, Marina, come see the show. And I was on my way home and I got a call saying that Laura, who was playing Zoe, was sick, which meant Olivia was playing Zoe, and I had to go on as Alana on Broadway that night with the entire original cast, yes, including Ben Platt. And I barely knew the material. Like, I had only done a week and a half's worth of work. So I called my mom and I was like, sorry, we can't go to dinner before the show. I have to go get ready. I don't even know what I'm doing. And I ran back to the theater. I did a couple things. We did a rehearsal with a few things that I had never done with them, that's very specific to blocking and what they are doing in the show, because I had only been rehearsing with the understudies. Miss a line, I didn't miss a song, and nobody hurt, but they did tell me that, you know, they really, really liked me and wanted me to keep coming back, but I ended up booking Les Mis, so I could not continue being the vacation cover. But I did have an inkling that I was probably going back because it was the same casting for Les Mis and Dear Evan Hansen. And I think it was our second city on tour. They reached out and were like, we would like Phoenix to come back and take over full time. Kristen's leaving the show. And it's funny now because Kristen and I were living together during the pandemic. So yeah. The show brought me a very close friend.
All your stories are just like miracles.
I mean, the pandemic has kind of stopped the
right soon enough.
Yeah,
they'll come back soon.
Very, very thankful. You know, I never thought this little from Philly would have amazing stories about how she would book these really jobs and get where she is.
Yeah, yeah. So when the show Dear Evan Hansen opened back in 2016, the original cast, of course, there was only one black actress
yes,
that played the role of Alana. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts about how the show has become more diverse over the years in casting, especially, you know, having Roman Banks, first black Evan Hansen?
Yeah, I think it's about time, you know. Roman going on as Evan was one of the most important things to happen on Broadway in that year. I believe it was 2018. It was so phenomenal to see this little black boy playing this role that had been so coveted by white men. And there's nothing in the script that Evan has to be white, or anyone has to be white. Anyone has to be black. It doesn't say Alana needs to be black. So I think it's about time is more diversity in that show. And I think they have started doing what needs to be done, what should have been done. And I think they can go even further with what they're doing. I was on for Alana, usually am, and Sky, Lakota Lynch, he is black and indigenous, and he was for Jared. And there's one point where just the three of us are singing, and that felt like the biggest black boy joy, black girl magic. That felt like the ancestors were giving us all the power, because there's this moment where we're all facing downstairs, and we sing No One Should Flicker Out, and we turn each other to sing the flicker out moment. The power that was just in that one moment. It's truly about 5 seconds, but it was everything to us in that moment. And I think it was everything to the people watching. There were so many people that were like, Phoenix, how do I get a ticket on today? So many people from Black were like, I need to see this. Is he going on tonight? I need to be at the show. Because it was such an important thing for the community.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of like looking at the full scope of Broadway and even beyond in regional theaters, how, what is your advice to white, you know, artistic directors or white directors in general about how to just be willing and be open to more diversity and inclusion in their shows?
Yeah, I think if you would like to have more diversity and inclusion in your shows, then there needs to be more diversity and inclusion in your stage management, in your crews, in your positions, because that is truly where the people will advocate. I think times people are like, oh, crap, we need diversity. Let's do one black show for this year and that's it. We made it. Let's make the one main character black or Hispanic or indigenous or person of color we can find. And that is not what needs to be done. What needs to be done is true inclusion across the board, as well as doing shows that are diverse. Like that is, I think a lot of people get confused when they're like, oh yeah, we want inclusion. It's like, we just need black shows or we just need this. Yes, we do need that. Yes, we do need shows that are just about Asian people or black people or indigenous people or Latinos. There can be shows that, like I'm saying about Dear Evan Hansen, how the show doesn't particularly say it needs to be that, but just because it's been done that way, that's the only way we can do it. Do shows that any type of casting you would like, and not colorblind casting, but color conscious casting. I personally have been having a discussion with the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival about how to get that done, mm-hmm. and how to not just do one show a year and say we did it.
Yep.
And how to afford more opportunities to more people of different races. And that doesn't mean like just hire them because they're a different race. Hire them because they're qualified and a different mm-hmm. race.
Yeah, I hit it right on the nail. I agree with hating that term, colorblind casting, because it's in life unless you're colorblind, you see color, you see someone's race. Right. So why say you don't when you're in an audition room, or it's always at play, you know, whatever. Even if you try and put it on the back burner, you're gonna deal with it at some point. So yeah. So on a lighter note, before we talk about, you know, the state of this world. Do you have a favorite musical that you've loved forever?
Oh, gosh. I, like, go in and out favorite in a moment rather than having, like, a favorite. But I will say, anytime I used to get asked that question, I used to love that show. I don't know if you know the show very well.
I do,
you
do? Yeah, okay. With Idina Menzel. Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was really cool the way that it's, like, the decisions you make each day, small decisions, big decisions impact where you're going. But in the end, you're always going to end up where you were supposed to anyway, no matter which path you take. And so I thought that was really cool. But I don't know if I have a favorite. I'm like probably one of those people. It's like whatever show I'm doing at the time.
Yeah. I do say that as well. Yeah, back when I did Ragtime, I was like, this is my favorite show I've ever done.
Yeah,
and I always go back to saying Hamilton is like the big, even though it's the stereotype, but I have my reasons for really liking it, being a legitimate
Absolutely.
Fan.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of people put a stigma around Hamilton because it is so popular and like it has become somewhat commercialized in a way. And so it's like, oh, of course you like Hamilton, but it's like, okay. It is a show that has allowed many job opportunities for black and brown people and is also putting them at the forefront of the conversation. So I think it's doing a great job.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. And even when the whole thing with, you know, slave owners, when the Disney Plus version came out, like that was a big thing and people were trying to say, you know, cancel Hamilton. It's just like, I feel like for me, like when that happened, it was like, okay, it's any excuse to make you say, this shouldn't be as good as people say it is. You know, anything that has to do with brown people being seen in a positive light, it has to be deemed in a negative way at some point. And I feel like it was just going on that route. And that, you know, I can talk for years about that. But yeah.
Yeah, I just think we should support people of color in their endeavors.
Very easy. Very easy
Point
task.
Blank, period.
Yeah.
unless they're saying some out-of-pocket stuff, then we can
talk about that another time. There are a few of those, but yeah, we know who they are. Yeah, so I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the state of the world right now. How are you dealing with this, both as an artist and as a human being?
Specifically events yesterday or just everything?
Yeah. At the time of this recording, especially the events that happened yesterday at the U.S. Capitol.
You know, I've heard enough people say if this was a Black Lives Matter, things would have gone very, very different. And they are right. There would have been so many people who would shot, arrested, killed. And to see barricades being moved and no one's knee is on anyone's neck, no one's being shot in the back 7 times. And it's sad to say this, but it's expected. This is the way it has been. This is the way it always has been. And I don't want to say it will be. That's the one thing I'm not going to say. But also just the state of the world in general, too, when it comes to the coronavirus and, you know, people being able to, like us being able to do our jobs, you know, things like that as well. Mm-hmm. It's hard, but I'm worried about the state of the world. I'm worried is quote unquote the greatest country in the world. You know, it doesn't feel so great right now. It doesn't feel so great in general. It doesn't feel so great for people of color. It's feeling better. It's feeling better. But the state of the world worries me a lot. But well, there is no but. There is no but, because I don't think I have anything optimistic to say at the end of that. These changes that we are making can snowball better changes and bigger changes. Mm-hmm. We're celebrating the small win, the medium wins right now in order to one day biggest win. I think that's what is happening right now in the country.
Yeah.
People need to go home. I think people need to wear their mask. I think people need to calm down a little bit, including myself sometimes.
Yeah, people need to live their lives and maybe not question so much, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe just wait things out. I've been saying that we are currently carrying the baggage that 2020 has brought us. And there's always action when we have visual representations of things, videos, footage, pictures, like, because we saw what happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday at the time of this recording is why, you know, this people are just going crazy on social media, which happened last year when George Floyd, it happened last year with Ahmaud Arbery. It just, the cycle just keeps going because we are getting these visuals. And I think that people just need to be having these conversations on a normal basis and not when they see these things come up.
Right. I think the visuals have been very necessary for people who have been living in their bubbles, especially people who don't want to talk about privilege or say it doesn't exist. I think that having visual representations outside of your bubble to see what we are really talking about, what is really going on, has educated a lot of people. Not as many as need to be educated, but it has educated a lot of people and started up many conversations. And let me tell you, Gen Z is out here wilding at these people, okay? Gen Z, y'all better go ahead, because the way they will tell someone correct information and also slap them in the back of the head at the same time with their words, I'm like, you took the words out of my mouth. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Pop off.
There you go. Said and done.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is your ultimate goal as an artist?
I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. My ultimate, like, tangible goal would be to finally, like, book that TV show or that movie or, you know. I don't think, like, when I was younger, I used to really want to be famous for what I did. I don't know if I want to be famous. I think I just want to be well known enough to book my job, collect my check, and live a happy life.
Yeah.
But I think my overarching goal is, and I've said this many times before, and it may sound cliche, but I would love to show that this little somewhat broke girl from Philadelphia, because as you get older, you realize how unfortunate, not unfortunate, but how not fortunate you were in certain regards. But thinking about that little girl who was so optimistic, there are so many more now who are in the same position, maybe even a little bit worse than my position, maybe a little bit better, who I hope can look at me and be like, she did it, so can I, which is what I felt like when I was younger. There were many examples of that for me. I just did not see enough of it. I was not around enough of it. So I would love to be that for someone else. I would love to have someone, just for the sense of knowing that I did it, fully know that they can, not think they can, not say they might, but know that they can. Yeah. I think that's like a huge thing for me.
That's great. Yeah. And in your journey, who and what has inspired you?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is another cliche answer probably, but my mom was a single mom working all kinds of hours with two daughters. And when so many people were like, your daughter wants to do theater, is that going to make her money? Or like, oh, your daughter wants to be a performer. She has a great voice, but like all the eyes and the looks and the things, people who tell you you're good or, you know, whatever to your face, but then are like, they don't believe in you. Like, my mom has never not believed in me. And that is the biggest thing to me. Like, she is my greatest inspiration for that, because she could have tried to dim whatever light I had inside at that time, 5, 6. You know, she sat there with my Winnie the Pooh stuffed animals and let me put on a whole production in front of her. Going from that to a Broadway stage, like, not every parent does that. And that is huge for me. And also to see her struggle throughout all of that while still supporting me and my sister to do the things that we wanted to do. She is truly my greatest inspiration. Yeah. I wish I could say someone in the industry. Like, I have many in the industry who inspire me, but like, my greatest one is 1000% my mother.
That's amazing. I also have a single mother, and I've had one, you know, past 21 years of my life.
Yeah.
So I know she has also never doubted me a single moment. And it's great when you're an artist, you know you're going into a profession that isn't guaranteed necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have that backbone, literally someone who you've known all your life to say, hey, do what you want to do. Just make sure, you know, you're doing the right thing.
And she was always honest with me. She'd be like, you might want to do this, or you might not want to do that. But she would always be like, oh yeah, you're going to make it. Like, I made a bet with her. My mom didn't drink for a while, and she she like stopped drinking right before she had me. Like, she, of course she had to, but then she just kind of like, life happened. She didn't really go out. She didn't really do things. And so I was like, Mom, you have to have a glass of wine with me. Like, when I book a Broadway show, you're going to have a drink with me. And she was like, all right, fine. And I ended up, you know, booking Color Purple. And when we finally went out to have that glass of wine, I was like, why did you make this bet? I was like, it happened faster than you would have thought. She was like, actually, no. She's like, I always knew this was going to happen. She's like, I thought it could happen tomorrow. It didn't happen tomorrow, but it happened when it happened. And so to know my mom thinks I'm great even when I'm not, and even when I can, you know, sabotage myself or not think of myself so highly, having someone there who will tell you the truth but also uplift you it's the best thing, yeah.
Yeah, shout out to single Black mothers.
Shout out.
They deserve it all. And Black women in general, you know. Black women are, as we can see, Stacey Abrams leading the game. Great. Do you have any last thoughts on anything we talked about?
I think my last thought is just, honestly, to you, I think this is quite amazing that you have started this podcast and that you reach out to so many people to interview and learn more and know more while you are currently working. I think as a former DeSales student, knowing what it is like to be a DeSales student and being so proud of who you are and what you have to offer, I think that's truly remarkable, because I cannot say the same from your position when I was your age. Yeah, I think this is just amazing. And well, kudos to you. Snaps around.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that means a lot. It means a lot coming from you. And I like the same gratitude towards you. Like, I look up to you knowing that you were able to do it, you know, that you do the thing that everyone strives to do right after graduation. So, you know, kudos to you and your talent as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to drop your socials for the people?
Oh, gosh. I have a newfound relationship with social media since coronavirus.
Me too.
But yeah, my handle on everything is Phoenix_best. I have an email on my Instagram attached, and it is specifically for anyone in the industry who wants to reach out. If you have a question, if you want to know more about how I got to where I got to, tips, tricks, things on where I got to, how I got here. I'm not the speediest at responding, but I will respond.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. You can follow me on social media at Black Dirt Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get updates on new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Keep listening for special hints about the next episode. Until then, I'm Gabe Moses, and Black Artists Matter.
Hey, Miss Natalie.